I'm very happy to welcome to the show now Mayra Levinson. She is associate professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education, and she's author of the new book, No Citizen Left Behind. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have a very interesting background. You have studied philosophy, political theory. You've been a teacher. You've done the whole Ivy League, Yale, Harvard, Oxford thing. You've also taught at totally African-American and Latino schools, poor schools in Atlanta and Boston. So what brought you to teach, for example, in a totally black school in Atlanta, Georgia?
So I went straight from my undergrad and doing philosophy at Yale to doing a doctorate at Oxford in political theory. And the doctorate was actually a little bit of an accident. I had wanted to do science education. I directed a science education program when I was at college, and I was really excited about that. And I frankly ended up following my boyfriend, now husband, happily, across the ocean. And so the doctorate sort of happened as an interim, but I was really pretty passionate about teaching. And by the end of that, I didn't have any plausibility as a science teacher because I'd never been a science major. But I basically felt that it was clear I could be a perfectly competent political theorist, but it was totally unclear to me that the world needed another perfectly competent political theorist. And I figured the world could use another at least perfectly competent teacher. I had no idea if I could be anything better than perfectly competent as a teacher, but even that seemed... like a step up, you know, especially in many urban schools those days, which were having a hard time attracting well-educated teachers. And so I decided, you know, it was both a sort of moral and civic obligation to do something that I thought would be good for the world. And I was intrigued. I was curious. I wanted to see, could I do it? Could I do it well? I knew that I enjoyed it. And so I thought, well, I'll give myself 3 years and see how it goes.
And so you start teaching at this school, and one of the things that you found was that it had very much of an Afrocentric curriculum for black students, which probably evolved after many years of fighting the system that only taught kind of like white history to black students. And there are pros and cons to what you found.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's interesting. There was a compromise, essentially, a political compromise in Atlanta in the 1960s or 70s, where essentially there was an agreement that the whites could control the business in Atlanta and the blacks could control politics and schools. And it was a pretty overt compromise among those in authority, both black and white. And so ever since then, there's always been a black political structure also controlling the schools, so superintendents, deputy superintendents, etc. And so I walked into a system that very proudly was a system basically by blacks for blacks. And it was very overtly a system that was designed to teach African American children. And so, for example, in No Citizen Left Behind, in the book, I describe going to a middle school conference, system-wide middle school conference, in which we had examples of step dancing, of double dutch. We had kids' choirs singing spirituals and other songs. And then there was the singing of Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is known informally as the Black National Anthem. And the only required class, professional development, I had to do was on African-American infusion into the curriculum. And there were some immense strengths in this. There was a profound, palpable pride in being African-American, in African-American history, in African history, in a sense of sort of longevity, of struggle, of, you know, success, and just a sense of you are part of a long and proud and noble history, and it is your obligation to, you know, keep that going. And not to slack off. And at the same time, there were some real problems with it, which was that in the eagerness to teach African American history and perspectives, there was little that taught either non-African American history and perspectives. There was little contextualization that was happening. And so I was worried about the ways in which once students, say, left if they chose to leave the predominantly African-American communities in which they were living and being educated, they were really going to be a little lost, because what they knew, others wouldn't know, and what others knew, they wouldn't know. And so, yeah, that's when I started sort of searching around to try to figure out how can we keep the sense of pride and the sense of the sort of your place in the struggle without reinforcing a sort of continued separation.
And this was illustrated to you in a really, I mean, at least to the reader, kind of funny way when you took the kids to a kind of academic contest with a white suburban school.
Yeah, actually it was a white urban school in that it was part of the Atlanta Public Schools. But yes, it was in the one sort of white wealthy part of town then, Buckhead. Yes, and had mostly white team. Yeah, and so we had this really stupid question that shouldn't have been, you know, part of an academic quiz bowl, but part of it was that they had to identify Kurt Cobain. And my students got it wrong. They thought he was a tennis player. And the kids from the other school, from this white team, they just laughed. And they weren't trying to be mean. They were actually quite respectful in general, even though they were trouncing us in this quiz bowl. But it was just so stunning to them. This was about a year and a half after Kurt Cobain's death, that 35 middle schoolers wouldn't know who Kurt Cobain was. And as we rode the school bus back down Peachtree Ave back to the neighborhood that my kids lived in, which was all African American and basically all poor, I asked these 35 kids, so do you know why those kids laughed? And they said no. And I said, well, it's because you didn't know who Kurt Cobain was. And they said, oh, well, you know, who cares? And I said, you know, do you know, have you heard of Nirvana? No. Have you heard of grunge? No. And I said, well, they thought...
Have you heard of Seattle?
Have you heard of Seattle? Right. Most of them had not heard of Seattle. And then I said, well, you know, from their perspective, that would be like, say, from your perspective, somebody not knowing who Master P was. And he was one of the reigning hip-hop artists at the time. And my student said to me, oh, Dr. Levinson, you don't understand. Everybody knows who Master P is. And I said, well, yeah, that's how the other kids feel about Kurt Cobain. And they said, no, no, you don't understand. Everybody knows who Master P is.
Right.
And that's when I realized I don't care if they know about Kurt Cobain. And I don't care if people know about, you know, Master P. But what I did care was that my students knew that Master P actually wasn't known by the majority of even, white America at the time. And that they also know, whether it's Kurt Cobain, they know what kinds of knowledge would be expected by, say, white America, middle class America, for them to have mastered, because that would be part of giving them power.
And it really brings up, as you say, this question of context, because, I mean, you write in the book, they know who Marian Anderson is, the great African-American opera singer, but they don't really know what opera is, and they've never been to an opera. And this whole question of getting a general education, I mean, I was thinking as I was reading your book, you know, I consider African-American history to be very much a deep and important part of my own life and my own culture and my own musical tastes and Afro-Caribbean music and all of those things are places where white Americans, brown Americans, purple Americans find themselves. And it's like, why shouldn't a general education be accessible to everybody, not white students study white stuff and black students study black stuff?
Right. I think that's definitely part of it, is that, you know, these grand cultural achievements and historical achievements, they are part of everybody's life and they enrich us all. And so we should get an education that exposes us to a wide variety of such achievements. Also, as a sort of more pragmatic matter, whether or not, you know, one should listen to the magic flute versus listen to, I don't know, Langston Hughes, right? And it's not obvious that, you know, if you have time for one, who knows which one you should get, you know, there's, but it, as a matter of power and being able to sort of negotiate society, it does matter that you have a familiarity with and exposure to the kinds of knowledge and ways of thinking that those who currently have power in whatever community you are trying to be a part what they know and what they think, and because that's the way to navigate it. Otherwise, you can't speak to others in a language that makes sense, using references that they will understand, making arguments that will sway them. And so for that reason especially, although it is equally important from the perspective of sort of the expansion of the human experience for white students to study Langston Hughes and Marian Anderson as it is for black students to study, say, the Magic Flute or, you know, whatever. In terms of power, unfortunately, it's far more important, I think, for the black students to make sure that they get exposed to what, frankly, is still very much of a white and middle class and upper middle class power structure.
Including learning standard spoken and written English.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I was teaching in Boston, one of my colleagues who taught science was really insistent with students that they learn how to talk right, how to speak correctly. And what that meant for her was that they get rid of any language that was a marker of being poor or essentially being non-white. So, you know, sort of black English constructions, I've been done that. He be going there, whatever. Also, certain Spanish constructions, you know, Spanglish constructions, etc. That all, and I was always really ambivalent about that, because she was right that they needed to learn how to speak standard American English and write standard American English. And at the
but
same,
but why would
time,
they have to get rid of the other?
Right,
one?
Exactly. And so I ended up reading about code switching. And this idea that it's not about giving up one's, you know, home language, one's familiar language, the way where you express yourself to friends, to family members on the street, whatever. It's about learning how to use different languages, different means of self-presentation, depending on the context that you're in. I think it's a much more empowering message for kids and for all of us, because it says, no, you don't have to give up who you are and how you speak or how your mom speaks. That's not wrong. It's just that that's not going to get you the hearing that you want. That's not going to get you the respect that you want in this other context. So let's
right.
teach you how to be bilingual or trilingual. You can hear that. Jesse Jackson was, you know, has been a master of that. You can hear him as he switches. But all, if you listen to Obama, he's a master of it. If you listen to almost any politician, they are masters of it, because when they're visiting down south, their, you know, their language changes, their pace changes, etc., their references change, and then when they go up north or to an industrial area, again it changed. We all code switch to some extent when we're with our family versus at work versus with certain kinds of friends, girlfriends, you know, other. So making that more overt and obvious and turning it into a bit of a game, but showing how that game can have power is really good, I think.
We're talking to Mira Levinson about her book, No Citizen Left Behind. There was a brilliant article by David Foster Wallace about 11 years ago about how important standard written English was, and he said it's basically like wearing pants. You may not want to wear pants if you're a man, and maybe at home you never wear pants, you only wear skirts, but if you go to a job interview, you've got to wear pants or you're not going to get the job, and learning English is like that. And all of these things basically feed into the very important questions that you are asking in this book, which is taking power, thinking about empowerment. What does it mean to actually start gaining a sense of what you call efficacy within a power structure, taking political power as a sixth grader, as an eighth grader?
Yeah. So, you know, as I said, I came to teaching straight out of finishing my doctorate. And in the dissertation, I wrote about the how important I thought it was for the state to help children develop the capacity for autonomy, the ability to basically make choices about the direction of their own lives. And when I started teaching in Atlanta and then continued teaching in Boston, I was challenged a lot in thinking, okay, what does it mean for these children in these spaces, going to these schools at this time, to take power over their lives? And one of the things that disturbed me is that, especially in Boston, and even more now, actually, nationwide, there's this, the notion of how you get power, especially if you come from a low-income community of color that's historically marginalized, et cetera, is escape. You get power as an individual. You get, in, you know, education as an individual, And then you go to college and you escape your community and you leave it behind. And that seemed both demeaning and degrading to the community. It seemed like a terrible choice that we were giving kids to say, well, the way that you can be successful and realize your dreams is to leave the people who love you and who you love. And it also seemed sort of obtuse in terms of thinking, well, that doesn't help the next generation who's being born there, right? So we can have this sort of individual out-migration, but what about the communities themselves? And so over time, I started realizing power had to be in part collective, and it had to also involve civic and political power to transform one's community and to work together collectively, not just for individual self-empowerment, but for community empowerment and transformation, because it's a terrible choice to say, well, the only way you can live the life that you want to live, free from fear of danger, enabling your own kids to go play out in your backyard or whatever, having a well-paying, you know, good-paying job in a stable community, et cetera, is to leave behind where you came from. And so if we're going to change that and make every place that somebody lives a place in which they can live that kind of life, then that has to involve civic and political power and collective communal work.
And so what does that look like to start to teach that for you as a teacher in, say, Atlanta?
There are so many. So one way is to take the stories and the perspectives of young people seriously. It's not to come in, especially as, say, a white middle-class woman, and assume that I have all the answers and that I'm going to teach them about all the things that they and their communities are not doing, and let me show you how to do them, right? Part of that is just because it's simply arrogant, and part of it is because it fundamentally doesn't engage with the kinds of challenges that those communities are facing, with the beliefs that the young people have about whether or not they can be efficacious, whether they can make a difference, and with sort of the realities of their knowledge. So like one of the stories that I tell in No Citizen Left Behind is about my conversation with my students in Boston on September 11th, when we were together on September 11th and watched the towers fall together. And then later that same afternoon, you know, this was still the same day. They had not gone anywhere except for the science and lunch. They had not talked to parents or, you know, listened to the news otherwise or anything. This was coming from them. They said to me that they knew who had planned and executed the terrorist attacks. I said, really? You know, we're like 5 hours into this. And they said, oh, yeah, George Bush did. President Bush did, and the reason he did that was to have an excuse to go to war with Iraq, and the reason that he wanted to have an excuse to go to war with Iraq was to avenge Saddam Hussein's attempted assassination of his own father, the first President Bush. That's a really different perspective, especially on the day of September 11th, from what I had or anybody else had. And even though they're right that Bush used it as an excuse to go to war with Iraq, I still think that they are utterly wrong about the idea that President Bush, you know, knew about the attacks, planned and executed them. But until I was able to engage with and take seriously their perspective, not because I thought it was right, but because it revealed, you know, when I said, well, why on earth would you think that, you know, a president, an American president, would do something like that? They drew on a lot of knowledge about what American presidents have done, including Bush himself. And they said, look at how he manipulated the Florida election, how he stole it, right? Look at all of these other things that have, you know, that American presidents have done that have been illegal, immoral, you know, power grabs, et cetera. They were knowledgeable. They took that knowledge in a different direction than I had taken it. But that taught me, along with some other things, that it wasn't about teaching them trust in the system and how to get engaged via trust. It was actually thinking about, okay, given that you mistrust the system, now how do you get involved anyway? And let's learn about how others do that. So let's, you know, meet some real people from the community who are trying to change the community, knowing that it's hard. Let's establish a community in our own classroom and in our own school where you are trusted and where you do have a voice. And let's actually do some citizenship projects where you take what you care about and you're passionate about, you learn about allies who are, you know, working on these problems, and you actually try to make a difference and you try to persuade others. And so giving students experiences with citizenship and actually making a difference in a variety of ways at the classroom level, the school level, and out in the community, I think that's what will really help help them develop civic and political power and resolve what I call the civic empowerment gap.
It's so interesting to be on the ground dealing with what I think a lot of us kind of deal with and then just shelve and don't think about it, but the like narrative as of America as this place with a great constitution where, gee, it's not perfect, but it's getting better, and, you know, women got the vote, and slavery was abolished, and civil rights happened, and, gosh, every year it's just a little bit better. And then this other reality, which is, you know, just a series of evils, one after another after another, which cultivates a kind of cynicism that you see in your students. And navigating that by actually doing stuff as opposed to philosophizing about it. One of the things that you did was you took a group of eighth graders in Boston to be jurors at a mock trial that was put on by Harvard law students. Mm-hmm. And this was a really empowering experience for all of them, including the law students.
Yeah, I think that sort of going back to this historical narrative, I mean, it is clearly true. Slavery was abolished. Women have gotten the vote. African Americans and other people of color have gotten the vote. There are civil rights movement happened, right? There are a lot of things that have happened. But oftentimes we teach that as if it sort of happened inevitably, right? As if we were founded on these ideals of liberty and equality. And although there were those problems at the beginning, you know, we are always inevitably approaching those ideals better and better. And especially when you have young people who are living in circumstances that don't permit them much liberty, when they can't even go outside and play or, you know, go down the street to a friend's house because they're worried about violence on the streets. When my students all the time would talk about living in a war zone, and for them this was not metaphorical. I mean, this was just how they experienced their lives. That notion that they live in a liberal and in a place that features liberty and equality can seem like a sham. And also, if once we sort of teach this story of inevitability, it doesn't really offer a place to really get involved and make a difference. And so, yeah, having the experience of saying, okay, no, you're right, it's not inevitable, and it's not as if everything is free and equal. But let's look at how people have struggled to get you even the opportunities you have today, because you do have more opportunities than, you know, your forebears did. But you have those opportunities not because of this magical, inevitable, you know, improvement, but because others struggled for that. And so now you have these opportunities. Now you have the obligation to continue the struggle. And that, I think, is in fact a more empowering notion than just, both there's this inevitable improvement and, you know, you live in such a wonderful place, wouldn't you want to get involved? The mock trial experience was really interesting, in part because it's a low stakes way to become part of that. So yeah, these were Harvard Law students who were, as part of their clinical law course, sort of for their final exam, arguing these trials in front of real jurors, but they were fake trials, so based on real ones. And they invited middle school and high schoolers in to be jurors. Most of the other jurors who came were from pretty lily white suburbs and from private schools. I think we were the only urban school at the time who was there.
And they showed up in their little hose and ties and skirts and things like
that. The other kids did.
The other kids did.
Yes, yes. My students did not. They tended to show up in their baggy jeans and their hoodies and their do-rags and stuff like that. I made them take their do-rags off, etc. Couple dressed up, but even their version of dressing up wasn't the same version as, yes, these private school kids with their pumps and their perfect little necklaces and so forth. And, yeah, the law students admitted when they saw my students that they were immediately terrified. Like, oh, no, they're not going to follow it. They're not going to pay attention. You know, I'm going to have to change everything. And my students had a blast, and every single year we did it, and we went for 5 years, they were incredibly thoughtful, they took it really seriously, they were articulate, they were focused, and not only did that give them a confidence that they could do something really profoundly civic of serving on a jury well, and that they could talk to adults and have adults listen to them and pay attention to them, but it really taught the law students and the judges and some of the clinical law faculty that, you know, you both can't judge a fellow citizen by how they look and dress, etc., and also that young people, including low-income young people of color, really have a contribution they can make. They can be constructive, productive, transformative for the good members of society.
And they probably, as eighth graders, brought with them a whole set of knowledge and moral wherewithal that maybe some of their suburban counterparts didn't even have.
That's interesting. It's possible. It's funny. One of the cases that got argued every single year was about a traffic violation. And so in that respect, my guess is that the suburban kids had somewhat more knowledge, both the high schoolers, because they may have taken driver's ed, and because even, you know, Boston high schoolers, very few of them own cars and are aware of traffic laws. But I'm sure that actually in the other case, that's probably right, that they did have certain kinds of insights that I imagine you're right, some of the other kids did not have.
We're talking to Mara Levinson about her book, No Citizen Left Behind. Mara is associate professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And the whole question of education in the United States, I mean, reading your book, it's really segregated. All our efforts in the 60s and 70s to desegregate have really just basically not worked out.
Yeah, all our efforts is a little strong. So there were many efforts to desegregate in the 60s and 70s, but one of the things that's so striking is, in a certain way, how few and far between those serious efforts were, and how often when there was any one effort, there would be other, you know, sort of counter efforts to, say, divide districts from one another, to cut things off from one another, to change funding mechanisms, to stop busing, to change busing, whatever. So there's quite good evidence that where desegregation was pursued very, very seriously, it worked and worked well. But unfortunately, there were so many countervailing pressures to it that, yes, the overriding narrative these days is that desegregation didn't work and it was a failure. And there's now this sort of language, understandably, saying where that takes the claims of desegregation to be, you know, you're saying that in order for my, you know, black child to learn, I have to sit next to your white kid. Well, why, you know, that's disrespectful. Why on earth should that be? And there's this whole move to say we shouldn't care about who's in the classroom. All we should care about is quality education. But I do believe that part of a quality education is learning from others and being with others and educating others about our own perspectives and learning from others about theirs. And also it's quite clear, in fact, as a policy matter, that where you have more white kids and more middle-class kids, you get better-funded schools and, you know, schools with more resources and support. And so, although, yes, it's possible to have a quality education that has, you know, all black kids, there's no reason that it's the whiteness of a kid's face that makes for a higher quality education. It is the fact that it's more likely that you will have more supported schools when you have more mixed schools, at least schools with more white and middle-class kids in them. But one of the things I am interested in is in No Citizen Left Behind is to think about, well, given how segregated schools are, rather than just, you know, saying, oh, if only we were, you know, less segregated, to think, well, what possibilities are there within segregated schools to make a difference? Because these kids are here now. We need to serve them now. We have an obligation now to educate them. And how can we teach them so that they really will come out with the skills and the knowledge and the habits and the capabilities to transform the world around them?
One of the things in the way of that is something that reminded me of that phrase, death by a thousand paper cuts, is microaggressions. Lots of ways in which black students, students of color, especially black males, really get the message that the world is not a safe place for them.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, and right, whether it's people crossing the street, you know, when they come by, whether it's being followed when they are in a store, whether it's having people, you know, just clutch their handbook closer, and then all these microaggressions that happen in schools of being disrespected in, you know, by teachers in all sorts of ways. Where I was struck, say in Boston especially. You know, we made kids sit together with their class in the cafeteria. We did not let them cross the cafeteria to go sit with a friend.
Why?
So it was this sort of vicious cycle, right? In part, so we had, say, 250 kids in the cafeteria at a time. We had 22 minutes for lunch. That's from the moment that class ended to the moment that the next class began.
So which just doesn't make sense either.
It doesn't make any sense. It's still the case in the Boston Public Schools. And the reason is that there's a certain number of mandated minutes of instructional time. And Boston has had actually one of the shortest school days of any district in the state or in the country. It's something that's currently a matter of negotiation between the administration and the union. But, right, so it's a way of, you know, maximizing at least instructional time on paper. My own kids complain about this all the time because they're in the Boston Public Schools and they keep coming home and saying, Mommy, I didn't have enough time to eat lunch today. But, so, you know, we're trying to get 250 kids in and out incredibly quickly, and we keep them cooped up in every other way, right? So we walk them from one class to another. These are kids who we then, at the end of the day, wave goodbye to, and they take the T home in many cases. They would take
the subway. Yeah.
They would take the subway. They were often taking care of little brothers and sisters and cousins and stuff. They would be cooking dinner. They would be taking their grandmother to the hospital and translating for her, you know, as she's learning about operations. They were incredibly capable kids who were doing so much outside of school. But we didn't trust them to do any of that inside of school. And so then in this sort of self-perpetuating way, if we had given them tons of freedom suddenly in this 20-minute period, it probably would have been chaotic. Of course, had we shifted everything about how we did things so that we showed them basic respect and we said, yeah, we can actually trust you to walk 100 yards down the hall from one class to the next, they would have felt the kind of confidence and trust that they then would have repaid by finding kids to sit with in the cafeteria, ideally having a little more time to eat, and then making their own way to class, where also ideally if we had treated them with respect in class, they would have wanted to be and they wouldn't have tried to cut. And, you know, everything, of course, builds on itself.
And that's not even talking about metal detectors and things like that.
Yeah, in my school in Atlanta, we wanded kids for guns and knives and so forth.
Wanded, like run a metal detector wand over their bodies,
yes,
in the morning when they go into
exactly.
school.
Exactly. And this was 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. So we're talking about 11-year-olds.
Yeah. Right? I mean, did they, just out of curiosity, did they find guns on these kids ever?
That's a good question. I mean, probably no, because one of the things that everybody knew was that the assistant principal couldn't stand there all day wanding kids, right? So by 10 minutes or something after the school day began, he would go off and do other stuff, and then you could just walk into school, you know, undetected. I mean, it was certainly the case that when I was teaching, in my 8 years of teaching, there were a couple times that there were guns found, and a few times that there were knives found. But again, you know, if you really want to, you know, kids are smart. That's one thing. We didn't treat them very much as if they were smart, but you can figure out how to get these things into school buildings if you want to. The other thing is, I mean, I talk about this a little in No Citizen Left Behind, that there's this sort of counterintuitive, bizarre thing where although the students appreciated our wanting to keep them safe in school, they also thought that we did not appreciate their need to stay safe coming to school and leaving school. And many, not many of them, but at least some of them felt as if they were going to safely make it to and from school, especially if they were walking through rival territory, etc., they had to have some kind of weapon on them to protect themselves. Now, I don't believe that they should have been bringing weapons into schools, but because we never asked them, we never talked with them about this, we never, you know, asked the kids with the knives, well, why do you have this here? We really missed an important learning opportunity. There's a really wonderful example in Chicago now where youth have been speaking up and partnering with police and other safety officials and community watch organizations and so forth to say, okay, if you want us not to have to travel with knives, you have to make this the streets safe. And there's the Safe Passages Initiative, where now just members of the community have agreed they will go out and sit on the front porches in the morning as kids are going to school. And it makes such a difference.
Very interesting. The book, No Citizen Left Behind, I mean, one of the really basic points of this book that one takes from reading it is that if you get young people involved in participatory ways, and you make a wonderful contrast between a kind of participatory citizenship and service learning, which you can talk about if you want, but if you get them involved in actually taking power within their communities, a lot of things change and can change pretty quickly.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that we so often view kids, and especially low-income kids of color, as these sort of cesspools of need and this just black hole of deficits, and as if they are delinquents and waiting and we have to keep them controlled and give them, you know, all this stuff that they don't have. And first of all, that's disrespectful. But second of all, it prevents us and the kids themselves from seeing all the ways in which they can really constructively and positively contribute to their communities and therefore to our communities. And so, yes, there are so many ways. I mean, like this example of the young people who sat down with the public safety officials and others in Chicago and came up with this, in fact, free way, right? I mean, just having homeowners and, you know, home renters come and sit out on their porch before school and after school. It's a brilliant way of sort of transforming students' experiences getting to school, and it changes attendance rates, and it changes, you know, student stress, and it changes the rate of attacks on kids, all sorts of things. Kids, you know, there's this wonderful example actually in Boston that's now spread Massachusetts-wide. There's a group of kids, the Boston Student Advisory Council, whose mantra is, we're the ones in the classroom, ask us. And they work together to develop what they call a teacher-friendly feedback form at the high school level, where they would give teachers friendly feedback about their experiences of learning in the classroom. And it was piloted in the Boston Public Schools. Everybody was very positive about it, including the teachers, because it gave the teachers information they could really use, gave the students voice, and there's now actually national research done by my colleague Ron Ferguson that shows that student survey results, that student evaluations of teachers is among the most informative information we can get about teacher quality, because they're not about favoritism and, you know, oh, he shows movies. They really want good education. So say this friendly feedback form is now going to be part of the statewide teacher evaluation system in Massachusetts starting next year. There's so many examples where kids have a vantage point where they can see things and understand things that we don't, and they have the motivation to change them and to do something about it because it affects their lives personally, and they can contribute and make a real difference, and then that benefits everyone.
I think one of the things you just said is so very important for people to understand and to think about, which is it's not cesspools of need and deficit, but what you have here is young people who, partly because of the need and deficit that, you know, if you want to call it that, have become really capable and resourceful and smart and capable of giving and really knowing a great deal about their environment and becoming leaders in that environment.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, precisely because they do not have many of the services, many of the opportunities, many of the whether they're luxuries or necessities that, say, many of us, who are middle class, take for granted, they become quite resourceful. Their families rely on them, right? So I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And, you know, we don't allow our 9-year-old yet near the stove, let alone ask her to, say, make dinner. And I would frankly be pretty surprised if at the end of middle school, my 9-year-old would, say, be capable of walking to the store near our house, buying the things that she needs to make dinner, coming home, making dinner, and having it on the table when I got home from work. It would be great, but that's not going to happen. I can be pretty confident. I can also be very confident that many of the 8th graders I taught were capable of doing exactly that. And So there is a whole resourcefulness set of strengths and abilities that kids develop. And it's just bizarre that we don't capitalize on those.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that you write about that I think is also really important is the proper role in the lives of young people of teachers and adults in their lives, not necessarily as disciplinarians. And it's not that you're saying you should have no boundaries, but as a kind of different relationship. How would you model that from your own experience?
Young people, all of us, every human being likes to feel respected, likes to feel as if who we are is understood, taken seriously, and as if we have authentic relationships with one another. It's pretty miserable being in a place for 6 or 7 hours a day in which you feel disrespected, as if you feel as if your capabilities are not recognized, in which you feel as if you are being asked over and over again to do things that you can't do or don't know how to do. And as if you're not really known as a person. That's a miserable experience for adults, and it's a miserable experience for kids. And so we should do differently. And teachers can and often do, but unfortunately often don't, in fact get to know their students and treat them respectfully and establish their classrooms as places where what kids know, who they are, what they care about, is part of the curriculum. That doesn't mean, you know, handing over the curriculum to them and saying, oh, well, you care about manga or fast cars or Justin Bieber, and that's going to be our curriculum, right? That's not it at all. But it's to take what they care about seriously. Do you care about identity? Do you care about bullying? Do you care about, you know, what it means to be Spanish in an English-dominant world? Do you care about music? Do you care, who are you? What do you care about? And let me help you understand how what we're studying relates to that. And let me give you opportunities every single day to show capability, not just to feel again and again and again as if you're, you know, knocking your head against the wall. So in my own classroom, we had a pretty democratic classroom structure. We had class officers, sometimes we had class mediators, and they were, you know, if there was some dispute and they said, Dr. Levinson, I'd say, go take it up, you know, with Marisol or whatever. And, you know, she was the one who everybody knew could mediate the dispute. So let's have her do it and not take my time. Then I could take my time to instruct or grade papers or do whatever I was doing. And we had technology officers, the kids who were really good with computers. Again, I could do the stuff too, but why not have them do it and get that respect and get some, they didn't get paid in real money, but I sort of paid them in other, you know, things that were useful for the classroom. That's part of it. Also, just having real discussions. There are studies that show in most classrooms, and especially in most urban classrooms, discussion takes less than 1% of the time in schools.
You're kidding.
No, it's just shocking. Like, unbelievable until you look at these studies after studies after studies.
What are they doing? The teacher's just talking and the kids are silent?
There's often that, or it's worksheets, right? So kids are filling out things, or they're reading textbooks and answering questions, or they may be working in a group on a project, but the work is not about exchanging ideas and listening to one another and critiquing ideas and so forth. It's about getting an externally imposed task done. If we don't learn how to discuss with one another, how to express our own point of view, use some evidence, some testimonial, whatever, to explain and justify our point of view, how to listen to others who disagree with us, how to make sense of that, we are going to have no productive civic and political life in this country. And I think we see that actually, you know, at work in Congress and in, you know, national and local public media and so forth.
And you have in Congress and public media and so forth, a total segregation where one group can't even talk to the other, which, you know, looks like originates in the schools.
Yeah. I mean, right. First of all, we are segregated from one another. So we live on our little bubbles. And so, I was struck actually, I was in Washington, D.C. In May, And I went to the Cato Institute, which is known as this quite libertarian institute. And I realized, I was having lunch there, and I realized that for the first time, I was actually having a conversation with somebody who believed that the Affordable Care Act was both wrong and unconstitutional. Now, there are millions of Americans in this country who believe that the Affordable Care Act is both wrong and unconstitutional, and who still believe that after the recent Supreme Court decision, right? Millions upon millions of Americans. It was my first and only time thus far that I have actually knowingly spoken to somebody who had that view, because I usually live in this lefty liberal bubble of people who think that actually, you know, that the Affordable Care Act is a good thing and is clearly constitutional. And that's not just me. That's so many of us. We live among people who have the same kinds of views as we do. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that that's true. We now are friends with and even work with people who have the same level of education as we do, the same level of income, the same family backgrounds. And then on top of that, when we do encounter people, either directly or indirectly through the media, who have different points of view, we automatically assume that they are insincere, that they're self-serving, that they're demonic, you know, whatever. And it's just crazy.
You have so much experience teaching young people, and you're at the Harvard School of Education, and you have just written this book. And this question, I think, that's so important comes up, which is, how do you share what you know in a way that other people will actually start using some of the things that you've learned? I mean, as you say, you know, hey, we're experts telling you this stuff. How come nobody's doing everything that we tell them to do? I mean, it's a real problem.
Yeah, it is the reason that, sort of as I said at the beginning of this interview, I decided that the world did not need yet one more capable political theorist, and I should just go do some real work instead, like teach middle school. And I frankly was quite ambivalent when I switched over to being a professor about that switch, because I thought, oh no, I'll just be stuck in my ivory tower. And, you know, people at Harvard are very good at feeling good about themselves and how Harvard is the center of the world.
Indeed.
You know, it's not true. And I was really worried about getting caught up in that self-important bubble. And I've actually, part of it is I've felt really gratified so far about the reception that No Citizen Left Behind has gotten. I mean, people who aren't, say, only interested in education have been reading and talking to me about the book. I've had some great conversations with teachers. I'm going to be talking with 600 school committee members and superintendents in Massachusetts this fall because they're interested. I'll be teaching to about 250, talking to about 250 LA area teachers in September. A bunch of sort of civil society organizations and civic education organizations have been using the book with their members, sharing them with board members and teachers and partners. And so I'm gaining a little more faith in the power of the written word, at least indirectly, you know, to transfer some ideas.
Well, especially, I mean, ladies and gentlemen, the book is very readable. It's a kind of among other things, a narrative of your own experience and quite gripping. It's not like some kind of dry educational text.
Well, good. That's certainly the way I tried to write it. Yeah, there's stories at the beginning of each chapter and sort of woven through. Yeah, so that was my hope, was to get a broader audience. So we'll see. I mean, that's one of the things I'm actually trying to figure out now, is how much of my time do I want to spend and do I need to spend working directly with teachers, educators, you know, superintendents, whatever, on helping them take some of these ideas and implement them in my classroom. I'm working as part of a group of writers on a voluntary multi-state curriculum that's for social studies that includes civics, and we're hoping to get some of these ideas about the importance of civic and democratic action into those learning standards. And if they do, and there are right now 21 states joined in this consortium, you know, that would be really exciting. And again, there's a huge space between policy, state level policy, and what actually happens in the classroom. But I'm hoping that sort of through this variety of ways, I can influence teachers in the classroom.
Mara Levinson is associate professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of the book No Citizen Left Behind. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.